I'm Rick Antley, NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Has seen its share of 10-year plans to end homelessness, but the hard truth is we're nowhere near ending it, with recent headlines showing that certainly to be the case. Concord has seen a huge debate this spring over the best way to help this population. Responding to concerns about public safety and property rights, police have evicted homeless men living in tents on private property and later on public lands, an action that prompted a lawsuit against the state. Also, the city passed an ordinance restricting how and where people can panhandle. Meanwhile, in Manchester, a church group hoping to serve free breakfast to the homeless in a downtown park was denied a permit, with negotiations now ongoing for another location. Meanwhile, the Queen City is about to launch a unique program toward panhandling, so-called homeless meters, where residents can donate to organizations that help the homeless instead of giving that spare change to an individual on the street. These approaches all have their detractors and supporters, those who call these policies band-aids versus those who believe action must be taken to protect property rights, public safety, and sanitation. But within the arguing, you do often hear a thread of agreement that a long-term solution is an enormous challenge encompassing poverty, housing, joblessness, and health care. Today in The Exchange, handling homelessness. Let's hear from you. What do you make of these recent stories about how cities are reacting to homelessness? Do you see these policies as sweeping people out of sight or as valid attempts to balance public concerns like safety with a desire to help vulnerable populations? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests with us in studio. Kathy Kuhn is here, director of the New Hampshire Coalition to End Homelessness and director of research and training at Families in Transition, a homeless service provider. And Kathy Kuhn, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here, Laura. Thank you.
Also, Tana Sisko, political sociologist at St. Anselm College. Her research is on public policy concerning the homeless. Her forthcoming book is called The Gendered Face of Homelessness. And Tana, good to meet you, too. Thank you for your time.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Representative Pat Long. He's an alderman from Ward 3 in Manchester and a Democratic state rep. He was just appointed member of the Manchester Consortium of Homelessness. And Representative Long, welcome back and good to see you, too.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, all of you, when we talk about the specific policies, I want to just put a broader framework over that for a moment, if we could. And Tana, to you first, when we talk about the homeless, I mean, who are we really talking about? And what's the public perception of who we're talking about?
Well, there's really two differences here in the public perception versus who we're talking about. Generally, for national terms of homeless, we see a rise in women and children as being our large group of homeless. But homelessness is interesting because it's very much an invisible population. So what we might perceive as being individuals on the street, or specifically for panhandling as being older men, that might not be representative in terms of who is homeless either across the state in New Hampshire or across the nation in terms of federal census. We also see an interesting, sad rise in the number of youth who are homeless, and as well as young adults over the age of 18, under the age of 30. So nationally, that's what we're looking at in terms of who is homeless. But our perception is still very much connected to that sort of 1970s, 1980s, the bag lady or the wino or the drug addict in terms of homelessness. So very stereotypical, deviant constructions of homeless, which isn't reflective of what's happening either at a local or a national sense.
So why is that? Because there have been, you know, a fair number of news reports over the years saying, look, it's mostly women and children, teens who have left abusive homes or whatever. So why are we hanging on to that bag lady or wino stereotype?
It's the visibility of it. And what's happening is it's sort of cyclical. That construction went away a little bit in the 1980s as more information and data started to get collected at homelessness at a federal level, and we started to see it was women and children. But then when you get these issues of panhandling come back up, then it's another thing that happens, and now it's, again, that negative construction. And what needs to be clear is that individuals who panhandle are not necessarily homeless, and homeless individuals don't necessarily panhandle. But we take those two groups and we sometimes smush them together, or we think of them as being within the same, and they might not necessarily. So we see really this sort of cyclical thing happen, where we see progress in terms of being a positive construction towards the group. Incidents happen, and it goes back to being what we call a deviant or negative construction of the group. And it just goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
And we'll definitely talk later on about Concord's panhandling ordinance and an approach that Manchester might take toward panhandling. But I'd love your thoughts too, Kathy Kuhn. Again, you've been working with homeless people for a long time. How do you think your average Granite Stater feels about this population?
You know, I think the compassion in the state is, there's a lot of compassion in the state for, and we see that in Concord right now with the group, with many citizens that are really, wanting to, take care of this population and really find a solution to the problems that we're seeing. On the other hand, I think that there is a lot of education that needs to happen around what, this population really is, about what they're doing. A lot of people tend to think, you see the people on the street and they tend to think that homeless people aren't working, when the reality is that we know that the large majority of homeless people, if they're not working themselves, they are out, they're looking for work, they're trying to get, back on their feet. So really, this is one thing that the coalition tries to do, is really to build that awareness around the realities of homeless people.
What's your thought, Kathy, and I want to hear from you too, Representative Long, about why now? We're paying a lot of attention to this now.
Yeah. Well, I think the visibility has increased. I think in our last point in time count, which happens every year, we do an annual count of homelessness, of people who are on the streets and in shelters. And in our last point in time count, we did see an increase of people who were unsheltered.
Really?
We did see a decrease of people who were in shelters, so that's a good sign, and an overall decrease, overall in total, in terms of total numbers, but there was a slight increase of people who were unsheltered. And so, that raises the visibility of the issue.
And Representative Long, I want to talk to you both as a state rep, but also someone who represents Ward 3 in Manchester. We feel compassion for homeless people, as Kathy said, and yet there are other concerns that public officials like yourself are trying to balance. Talk about that a little bit, if you could.
Yeah, the balance is very difficult. You have the Chamber of Commerce that is looking to put on a good face in Manchester. Ward 3 is the inner city, is the downtown Manchester. So that's the first look that visitors see. Veterans Park is across the street from the Radisson, which a lot of the homeless congregate there. So they see first Manchester has a homelessness problem city. I just need to correct the ongoing negotiations with the breakfast. We did negotiate an amicable to both of us where they're going to stay with the Salvation Army, and we just added some sandwiches that they could go out and give to the people that don't come there, and they like that better than being in the park.
Great. So you've come to an agreement.
Correct. Yeah. So you have the humane thing to do is to help people that are homeless. With respect to the panhandling, I spoke with people downtown that I saw given change to people asking for it. And their sense was, sometimes I don't do that, and when I go home, I feel guilty because I'm supposed to do that. I've been taught all my life I'm supposed to do that. But now you're telling me that it may be better to donate that spare change to an organization that's helping homelessness than to actually give it to them. And that's where we decided on these meters, so that you're able to give your spare change and not go home feeling guilty that, geez, I should have given my spare change.
Because sometimes the concern is, will that person use it for substance abuse or whatever?
That's correct.
What do you hear from downtown residents, Representative Long, and downtown businesses, again, as they sort of work through this issue of compassion, but also, they want people to come to their businesses. They want to feel safe when they walk home and so forth. What do you hear from people?
Yeah, I mean, an interesting thing that I see in here is the public view is different than their private view. Their public view is help them. What can we do? What more can we do? But when they go behind the curtain, it's different. So the education, I agree, is foremost of importance. Is within the education system. And when I talk about homelessness, it's people that are couch surfing. It's people that are living in their cars. That's all the range. And I look from, 12-year-olds to, you know, up to identified as 70-year-olds also.
Wow.
So there's a big, you know, there's plenty of issues. With me, the positiveness of this is I believe that a big bite can happen, can be taken out of this through organizations like Families in Transition. You know, I believe that there's three aspects of homelessness. Those that, because of a loss of job, because not being able to pay rent, you know, these people want to go to work and they want to have a place to live. And then there's those that are struggling with qualifications for work. And then you have the substance abuse. So, you know, if you could, you know, what was said earlier, data is just key. And we're starting to collect data in Manchester to identify what services do they need and chop that block off as the services are provided.
Take it bite by bite, in other words.
Correct.
You know, I'm real interested, Tana Sisko, in what Representative Long said. He, in terms of public attitudes, he said people will say one thing up front, you know, help these folks out, but behind the curtain, a little more mixed feelings.
We have a great saying for that. It's the NIMBY, not in my backyard. It's okay to have a shelter someplace. It's okay to have a soup kitchen. But as long as it's not near my house, then that's all right. And we've seen that over time in terms of research, that that's feelings and sentiment that people have. There's a competingness in terms of how people feel emotionally about these types of social problems like homelessness. There's almost a what we call a sympathy etiquette, how we feel for a little while, a moral worthiness to the individual that we're deserving to or deserving help, if there's a deserving poor aspect. But our sympathy cup becomes full after a while if we put too much into it.
Or if we see too much.
Or we see too much. And then it turns into what we would probably call a personal ambivalence. All right, I'm not going to help. I'm not going to do this. Or I did my part. Now I'm done. But as long as I don't see it or as long as it's not near me, I'll be okay with that.
Yeah, interesting. And that's certainly come up in communities where people feel sympathetic, but then they don't want the soup kitchen in their backyard. All right, we will take your phone calls after a short break. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Want to join the exchange team? The Barber and Dick Couch Fellowship is your opportunity. NHPR is looking for a recent college graduate savvy with social media and eager for hands-on experience with New Hampshire's signature statewide talk show. Apply today at nhpr.org. More on handling homelessness coming up on The Exchange at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, America's Energy Future Beyond Oil and Gas. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and Business and Industry Association, New Hampshire Statewide Chamber of Commerce, celebrating 100 years as a Granite State's advocate for business, BIA of NH.com. From Waste Management, with a reminder, new energy-efficient CFL bulbs contain mercury and need to be recycled properly. Details on bulb recycling at thinkgreenfromhome.com. And Exeter Hospital, helping you know how to perform life-saving CPR by sponsoring a public CPR training class Saturday, June 8th at 9 a.m. Registration at 580-6668. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a growing awareness and focus on homelessness in the Granite State and the responses of several communities. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guests are Pat Long, Alderman of Ward 3 in Manchester and a Democratic State Representative from the city. He was just appointed member of the Manchester Consortium of Homelessness. Also with us, Tana Sisko, political sociologist at St. Anselm College. Her research is on public policy concerning the homeless. And Kathy Kuhn, director of the New Hampshire Coalition to End Homelessness and director of research and training at Families in Transition. And Kathy Kuhn, to you real quick before we go to our listeners, what do you make of the big, big controversy here in Concord about the police evicting homeless people off of public land, first private property, then public land, out of concern for safety, sanitation, and so forth? What's your take on that?
Right. Well, you know, so the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union is suing the state over these evictions. And basically, they're arguing that there are no alternatives. There's no place for these folks to go. And so, you know, there was the hearing a couple weeks ago where they gave the, you know, the attorney for the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union more time to file her legal arguments. And so that there, in the meantime, folks are not being evicted from these public lands. Now, the issue, of course, is that this court case, whatever happens, is not going to resolve the problem. Because even if, you know, the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union wins this case and they are able to remain on these public lands, I don't think that's a win for homeless people in general. You know, living outside can be violent. It can be dangerous. It's extremely hard on your physical, on your mental health. And so, you know, having folks live outside is a problem. And so I think we're looking at this as really a moment where we can sort of bring attention to that issue and to really try to find long-term solutions to the problem. And living outside certainly isn't it.
Joining us now on the phone with a little bit more on this situation in Concord is John Duval. He's Concord's police chief. He also serves on the mayor's task force on ending homelessness. And Chief Duval, welcome back to The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good morning.
Well, before we get into the public land dispute, what sorts of requests or complaints is your office getting when it comes to homeless people, especially in the downtown area of Concord?
Well, what happened this year when the weather broke and at the onset of spring, we saw a proliferation of behaviors that occurred primarily in the downtown area next to the what's known as the Concord Center. And private landowners began calling us really every day, complaining of different types of behaviors, homeless folks who were living behind there on their property, approaching people going to work. Criminal-type behaviors. There was a deterioration of land, and there were some serious sanitation concerns. And they asked the Concord Police for some relief. So what we did is we began a strategy of going down there and informing those folks that it was private property and soon they'll be asked to leave. And that that progressed into us giving warnings for them to leave. And after a few weeks, if they didn't leave, then what we end up doing is giving them citations for trespass. And our strategy was not to take these people into full custody arrest as we typically would with criminal trespass, but just basically say that you're not wanted and we've told you that, and so they end up getting tickets. And there were about 20 people that received summonses for a court appearance for trespass, and that was the early part of May.
Then the public property issue came up, right, Chief Duval? There were some folks who were living on public lands, and they were told to leave, too. What was the concern there?
Well, that didn't happen all of a sudden. It actually, really through 2012, there was an explosion of folks that were living behind what's known as the Everett Arena in Concord and along the river. There were probably 40 to 60 people, depending on what time of the year it was, living back there. And the Concord Police responded to a variety of felony-level crimes, including felony assaults. We had two drownings. We had an attempted homicide. And it was just an area where we needed to act. And I couldn't agree more with all of the comments that your guest made this morning. I totally agree with everything that they said. So we, with the help of the state, obviously, because it's state property, moved those folks along, and that was done by December 15th in conjunction with the winter shelters opening up. So what happened this spring, the state took action and posted those areas and others in terms of no camping, which brought on the lawsuit. So it was a problem that progressed from last year, if you will.
How do you work your way through this, Chief Duval? I mean, you've talked about and you've written that you've got sympathy for people who are homeless. You know, you had a difficult background yourself, and so you understand what it's like to struggle. On the other hand, you're the chief of police. You can't have assaults and drownings and attempted murders.
That's true.
How do you work through that?
Well, this is a complicated problem, and Quinn, I'll be honest with you, this should not be a law enforcement problem, and by default, it becomes a law enforcement issue. But really, it's a societal issue in terms of how I see it. And your guest this morning mentioned that the homeless issue really isn't totally represented by the individuals that are making the newspaper and are who are having behavioral problems downtown. It's very, very complicated. It's folks that are trying to get back to work and maybe staying with relatives or friends or moving from this place and that place. And it's unfortunate that the small population of folks that are acting in a criminal-like way are creating the impression for everybody else, because that's not the reality of it.
Yeah.
So we have to walk a very delicate line, and we have to enforce laws and make sure that not only is society safe, but the population of folks living outdoors, they are safe. And unfortunately, they are the ones that have become the victims of these assaults and drownings and other things, including suicides.
You know, our guests did say, as you pointed out, Chief Duval, that yes, there are a few people making headlines, but a lot of the homeless population is women and children and families going from place to place. One more question, though, about the folks camping on private and then public land. When your officers tell people to leave, where do you tell them to go?
That is so hard. Well, first of all, we don't go looking for folks. It's like the squeaky wheel gets the grease. If somebody's complaining, like a citizen or a business, that's what brings us there. We know folks are living outside, and we pretty much know where they're living. And if they're minding themselves in terms of behaviors, we don't go harassing them and that type of thing. But when we ask them to leave, the answers are very shallow. I mean, there aren't many answers. I mean, we can't give them permission to go to other people's private property, and we can't give them permission to establish an outdoor residency on public land. So it's very, very difficult. We offer resources. We work very closely with advocates in the city. But clearly, there's an unanswered problem with homelessness in this community.
One more question.
And across the state.
Yeah, one more question for you, Chief Duval. And this has to do with something you and I talked about a couple months ago, and that's Concord's new panhandling ordinance. This doesn't say you can't panhandle at all, but it restricts where and how. Here's an email that I just got, Chief Duval, from Chris in Concord. She says, with the recent panhandling laws, evictions from public lands and property seizures, I'm concerned that Concord as a city and New Hampshire as a state are essentially addressing this in the least effective way through criminalization of homelessness. Chris says this is not only an ineffective strategy, it is expensive, taxes on an already overburdened legal system. We need real solutions to homelessness, not criminalizing people for what they're doing, for what they must do in order to survive. I know this has been a critique of the panhandling ordinance, and I wonder what you think, Chief Duval.
Well, I think that's a broad way of looking at it, but I mean, I look at it a little bit different. Again, I'm talking about behaviors of individuals. We have our share of people who have homes, who have apartments, who engage in criminal behavior, and we deal with those folks like we would anybody else. The folks that engage in criminal behavior that are homeless, again, represent a small portion of those who are suffering from homelessness. And to say that there aren't resources to feed people, to clothe people, for hygiene requirements and needs, I can only speak for Concord and say that there are adequate resources, and that the Concord Police will work with any organization or entity and ensuring that folks that need something get what they need. So I understand the perspective, but it's a little bit more detailed than that.
All right. Well, Chief Duval, thanks for sharing a few minutes of your time with us this morning. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's John Duval, Concord's police chief, who also serves on a mayor's task force on ending homelessness. And let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And as we look at this issue, all of you, I want to bring in the voice of someone who is living this issue, literally. Frank is with us on the line. He is a homeless person living in Concord. He's part of the tent camp lawsuit against the state that we just talked about. And Frank, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
No problem.
Can you tell us briefly, Frank, what led you to become homeless?
The state shut off my state disability.
The state shut off your state disability. And why did you have a state disability, Frank?
Well, I have a few reasons. I need a knee replacement. I have AFib. I have sleep apnea. And so basically just unable to work. A steady sort of job. I could work a couple hours a day at best.
So health issues make it tough for you to hold down a full-time job, and then the state cut off your disability payments, so you just couldn't make it. Is that it?
Yeah, last June I went to get the rent from my card, and it wasn't there. There was no money there. They had shut off my disability.
And what was the reason for that?
That the feds had turned down. The feds turned me down, so it's sort of a new thing that was passed in New Hampshire in 2011, I think, that they won't continue to the state disability while your appeal is in process. So once the feds turn you down, the state shuts off their funding.
Wow, so you've been homeless for about a year, it sounds like.
Well, actually, most of the last 20 years, but this since last year, yes.
Wow, mostly for the last 20 years. Is that because of your physical health problems, Frank, if I may ask?
Yeah, yes. I didn't have any insurance when I had an accident and it screwed my knee up, so I couldn't get it addressed. And so since then, I've really been, I did carpentry remodeling, sort of physical work before, and I was unable to do that at that point.
Sure, hard to transfer those skills elsewhere, and you can't do what you're trained to do. So, Frank, right now you're in a dispute with the state over your right to camp on public land. We heard earlier from Chief Duval about some of the concerns from these tent camps. There have been some assaults, two drownings, attempted homicides, and so forth. What's your side of the argument? Chief Duval has his concern about public safety.
Well, where we're at, none of those issues apply. Anybody and a number of people have been up where we camp. There's not a mess like the state has the pictures of. There's not the incidents. There's no police calls to the area. That just doesn't apply to us.
So you're keeping it clean and safe. So if you're not causing trouble, leave us alone? Is that what you mean?
Well, that would be a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
They said living outside isn't really a solution. And it's not a solution, but it is it's a heck of a step up in when you're really down and out.
Why aren't you in the shelters, Frank?
Why?
Yeah. Why live outside? Why not try and seek a bed in a shelter?
Well, there isn't really any shelters in Concord. There's one that's full, and quite honestly, they actually said I didn't show enough humility to be able to stay there.
Humility.
Yeah.
So the winter shelters, do you access those, and then come spring you're looking?
Correct.
What are you going to do, Frank, if this court ruling goes against you and says, no, look, folks, you can't camp on public land? Where are you going to go?
Some other public land that they don't know about.
Right. You know, these controversies, Frank, have shed a very public light on people like you who are homeless. One of our guests said, you know, the invisible population. Do you feel invisible as you walk around Concord, or do you feel more visible these days?
Well, with this going on, more visible. But
right.
As far as most of the people wouldn't know that I was homeless or this and that, I mean, I'd probably stand behind line and somebody at Walmart, and they don't know my living situation any more than yours.
How do people react to you, Frank, when they know you're homeless?
Fine.
How would you say Concord has been in terms of, you know, Chief Duval mentioned there are services, there are places for people to go. I wonder what you think about Concord as a welcoming community.
Well, the people and the citizens and the churches are fantastic. That's why we have the support system. That's why we have the Friendly Kitchen, the Concord Homeless Resource Center, places to get, like you said, soaps, shampoos, laundry detergents, clothing, bus vouchers, laundry tickets to go get your laundry done, showers to stay clean with. It just seems to be the government dragging its feet on coming up with a permanent shelter.
Well, Frank, thank you very much for being with us. Tough situation for you, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. That's Frank. Again, he's a homeless person living in Concord, involved in that campsite lawsuit that we've been talking about. Let's hear from you, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. As we look at some of the new policies, new approaches in some communities toward homelessness, we'd love your thoughts, questions, comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, let's go right to our listeners who've been waiting. And Ian is calling from Derry. Hi, Ian. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good. Hey, I wanted to pick up on something that a couple of your guests have mentioned by different name, actually. One of your guests mentioned the difference between our public views and our private views. The other mentioned something about, not in my backyard, the NIMBY effect, if you will. And I really think that kind of speaks to to the problem. We seem to have this separation, I think, between perhaps you could call it compassion for the condition versus compassion for the actual person. And I think it would serve us well to remember that this is a human condition. This is a problem with human beings. You know, things like the meters for your spare change, I think that those serve to do ultimately is separate us, the individual, from the actual homeless person, and encourages us to attend to, you know, perhaps the socioeconomic problem rather than the human condition itself.
You know, this is real interesting. Ian, can I ask you a quick question? I'll ask Pat Long about the meters for the spare change that they're looking at in Manchester. But, you know, one of our guests, I think it was Tana Sisko, said people broadly feel compassion for homeless people, but they don't want the shelter in their backyard. Right. How would you feel if they built a homeless shelter in your backyard?
You know, I, in all honesty, I have a homeless person sleeping on my couch right now.
Really? Wow.
Yes, absolutely. My wife and I and our six kids over the past few years have heard, lived in areas. We recently moved back to New Hampshire from Western Pennsylvania, and it was just a collapsed economy out there, just completely depressed area. And I literally had people knocking on my door asking for food, looking for places to sleep. And I'll tell you what, I mean, until I was confronted with that on a personal level, you know, I was content to, you know, put a couple extra dollars in the offering plate on Sunday morning to attend to the homeless or volunteer to soup kitchen. But really, I think, you know, those organizations are going to have limitations put on them by whatever governing authority they happen to have to answer to. But the individual, you know, I have the rights and the ability and the freedom to give food to whom I think needs it, or to give a bed to somebody that doesn't have one. And you know, in conjunction with these organizations and with government programs, I really think that that's a key piece to it. You need to, as individuals, we need to, you know, literally, you know, love our neighbor.
Do your part.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just because there's an organization out there, and I'm not speaking against them, I think that there are many that are doing fine work. But because there are organizations out there, that does not leave us as individuals from our social and ethical responsibility to these
people. Ian, it's great to hear from you. We'll pick up on that thread of who's responsible. I'll also ask you your thoughts, Representative Long, about the meters. Thank you so much for calling, Ian. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members in the Flexible MBA at the University of New Hampshire. For working professionals, evenings, weekend, or online, AACSB accredited in a new business school facility, mba.unh.edu. The Stroke Program at Catholic Medical Center, a comprehensive stroke program dedicated to improving recovery rates for stroke patients. Information at catholicmedicalcenter.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR's short June membership drive starts on the 12th. When we meet our goal for the day, we'll earn a $10,000 challenge grant from the Byrne Foundation. You can help keep us on track with a gift of $50 or $500 or something in between. Your donation today will count towards that first day goal, that $10,000 challenge, and it will help us bring you more of the programs you rely on. Make your gift now at nhpr.org. And thanks.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a rising consciousness toward issues surrounding homelessness in New Hampshire. We've been looking especially at the reactions in Concord and Manchester that have come up with some specific policies lately. You can join our conversation 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Kathy Kuhn, Tana Sisko, Representative Pat Long, couple follow-ups from the people we heard from in our last segment. First of all, Ian called Representative Long, taking issue with Manchester's idea to have homeless meters where you can put spare change. Instead of giving it to the individual, you can put it in a meter, which would go to a homeless service organization. That way, people don't have to worry that their money might go toward alcohol or drugs. Ian said, but that also removes us from the individual. It makes it more of a dispassionate action. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, first of all, I want to, I believe Ian is one of the persons that is far and few between. I don't know how many people that are taking homeless people in and staying on their couch with six children. But the meter disconnect, I agree with him. Now, I have to preface my remarks with I haven't been to school on this. I'm an iron worker. So this is just my perception that the meter disconnect, I do agree with him. I believe that there are appropriate places where there needs to be a disconnect. And the business community in downtown Manchester restaurants, that ought to be one of those disconnects. That doesn't mean that it's a disconnect throughout the whole city, but in certain areas there needs to be that disconnect. And I first of all, I think that these meters will help put Manchester back on, back in their business community on a positive note, and also would also help these nonprofits that will benefit from this change.
So you see his point, but there's another side to it too.
Exactly.
Especially since Manchester's really trying to revitalize its downtown. The businesses don't want panhandling downtown.
Correct.
You know, another issue that came up in that earlier segment, this is the broader idea raised by both our caller, Ian, and again, Ian, thank you so much, also by Frank and Chief Duval. And I think I'll turn to you first, Tana, but want to hear from you too, Kathy. Who's responsible? I mean, Frank talked about the federal government cut off his disability, so boom, he's homeless because he can't work. Ian talked about churches and organizations are doing a great job, but he feels his own personal responsibility. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, that's the question that has been asked over and over and over for probably at least the last 70 years. Who's responsible? We saw examples of this, or the shifting responsibility, in the 1950s and 1960s in terms of federal responses, specifically towards a group that's a part of the homeless community, but not just all homeless. And those are individuals who have some type of mental illness. So with the deinstitutionalization of mental illness or of closing of hospitals in the 1950s and 1960s, and those closings were really a shift into, we're not going to lose these individuals, but we are going to allow more responsibility in terms of community-based treatment programs. The problem with that is that the funding and those community-based treatment programs started to fall apart. And then we see issues in terms of individuals with mental illness, where are they going to go? If the government's not there, if community-based programs aren't there, what's going to happen?
And they ended up on the street.
And they ended up on the street. And I think this is a similar type of idea that's happening. The federal government pulling back in terms of some things. We do have federal policy on homelessness. We only have one, the McKinney-Vento Act. And the McKinney Act, in its original form, was in the 1980s. But we see a shift more at the local level to taking care of individuals. And that can become very burdensome when we have high pockets of homeless individuals, as well as connected to times of economic crisis like we've had in the last 5 years. And it puts more strain on our local resources to be able to do everything that's necessary for individuals who are homeless, whether it's provide housing, temporary housing, or even training programs. All of that can become very burdensome.
Okay, and I have to ask you this, even though I do want to get you into this too, Kathy, mm-hmm. and go back to our listeners. You talked about the responsibility shifting more locally. Frank, the homeless gentleman who we talked to, said in general he thought Concord had done a great job. The churches, there's organizations, there's a lot of support here for homeless people. Concord has a reputation as a compassionate community. Some people worry, Tana, that if a community is too compassionate, it will become a magnet for homeless people. True or not?
Oh, that's a tough one. Well, you know, homeless are generally what we would consider a transient population anyway. But in terms of maybe out-of-state shift to transient, that's, I think, a jump. I guess I would have a hard time saying that, yes, the more compassionate that they are, you know, more people are going to be drawn to there. I don't necessarily know that that's true. And I don't know that there's any research that backs that up. I don't know of any study that's looked at that and that's focused on that as well. Policies against homelessness, policies against panhandling are not new. they've been around for some time. And we see it in major cities that they enact certain types of policies that might not prohibit panhandling across the board, but prohibit certain locations. Panhandling, or as begging, is protected under free speech. But again, it depends where it happens.
All right. And another question for you, Kathy Kuhn. Frank said that one of the reasons he wasn't staying in one of the local shelters was he didn't show enough humility, to use his words. Now, obviously, you know, we don't know the particulars of his situation or the shelter and so forth. But is there a problem at times with fitting people into the shelters in terms of, you know, the rules and regs that the shelters have? And some people like Frank feel kind of bossed around.
There is. I think sometimes, sometimes people say people choose to live on the streets. My personal feeling is that no one chooses to live on the streets. I think if Frank had the opportunity to live in a safe, affordable place where he could live with dignity, he would certainly do that. And sometimes people, you know, live on the streets because they may have an untreated mental health issue, an untreated substance use issue, or they may not want to enter a shelter. And that's what we saw from Frank. He said it was because of, you know, he didn't have enough humility. Sometimes people don't want to enter shelters because they might be a dry shelter, meaning that, you know, it doesn't allow someone to enter after they've been drinking or using substances. And so for someone who has a substance use disorder, an untreated substance use disorder, that can be very, very difficult. Why would they set themselves up to fail and enter the shelter when they know they're just going to get kicked out? On the other hand, they may not want to enter a wet shelter. Some people don't, where there is, you know, people who are using are allowed to enter. People who have recovered from substance use disorders don't want to enter a wet shelter because they're afraid that they'll get triggered and, you know, tempted to go back to using. So there are these rules and regulations, and they're not consistent across shelters. And so that can be very difficult for homeless people to navigate.
Wow. All right. Let's go back to our listeners. And Harold's calling in from Concord. Hi, Harold. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, no problem. People have to understand that we are people, too, the homeless, and there are several landlords that I've ran into that won't rent to homeless people because they're homeless. Even though they have an income that can afford the rent, they won't rent to them, and that shouldn't be done. But people need to understand that, hey, we are people, too. You know, I've run into hard times. I was a truck driver for 15 years over the road. Now I'm homeless. But people don't understand that. People don't realize that, you know, we're people too.
So, Harold, you're trying to rent an apartment, but landlords won't rent to you because right now you don't have an address. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I have an income, but I don't have any work. I'm on disability right now, but landlords won't rent to me because I'm homeless.
Wow. So where are you living now, Harold? I'm just curious.
Well, I'm out in Pembroke, but I'm in Concord at the Homeless Resource Center because I am homeless.
Okay. Harold, good luck to you, and thanks for calling in. Representative Long, this gets us into another topic, affordable housing and landlords willing to rent to people who are homeless. It brings in so many elements here.
Yeah, I have to agree. I just like to go back to the magnet. I know Manchester has been keeping data on people from Lowell, Lawrence, that area coming into Manchester. And also, it's not necessarily from out of state. It's your Pembroke, Suncooks, your smaller towns that don't have any support system for homeless, so they move into Concord, Manchester, or wherever.
So there is a concern that if you offer too much, yes, too many people will come in and seek it?
Yeah, but I personally, you know, my personal opinion is you have to overlook that. You can't concentrate on it. If that's going to happen, that's going to happen. But you're absolutely right. I there are landlords that for whatever reason, their personal feeling is that it's not conducive for them to have somebody staying in their place that's on Social Security, even though they could on disability, they could afford it. They just don't want that stigma of the guy next door has no job and he's coming in homeless. So that's a problem issue in their mind.
Yeah, and how do you get around that, Kathy? I mean, you know, a landlord is a business person. He's not a community nonprofit organization. So how do you talk to people? What would you say to that landlord that Harold talked to? You know, look, this is going to be okay. I mean,
it's a trust building.
It's hard.
Yeah. And it's about building trust and educating landlords. I think a lot of times there's really creative partnerships between nonprofits and private landlords where nonprofits can go in and say, look, you know, if you house this person, we will work with this person. We will provide the supportive services that that person needs so that if you have a concern, if something is happening, if he's bringing in, you know, guests, too many guests, if he's making too much noise, we will jump in and we will do what we can to help you with that. So there are
you're not on your own here.
Right. There are a lot of creative ways that we can work around this.
Well, thanks for that call, Harold. And again, good luck. Here's an email from Dorothy that came in from Albany. She says, you're concentrating on the southern cities, but there is homelessness in the small towns, especially up north. It's just not obvious. One group of homeless you haven't addressed are the veterans. Here in Carroll County, we have no shelters. Dorothy says, I've been working on opening one in the county, but it's very difficult. People here don't acknowledge there are homeless, but ask any teacher and you'll find out all about them. And Dorothy, from my many times spent in the North Country, I know you're absolutely right. Thank you so much for the email. What do you think, Kathy? I'm going to turn to you again. You're director of the New Hampshire Coalition to End Homelessness. It's not just in Concord and Manchester and Nashua and so forth.
It isn't. There is no county in the state that is immune from homelessness. There is homelessness in every area of our state. And I think she brings up a really good point around the schools because that is sometimes where we see it the most. So, you know, last year in the 2011-2012 school year, we saw more than 3,300 children who were identified as homeless.
3,300
children identified in New Hampshire schools as homeless.
And not all in Manchester.
And not all in Manchester, although there was the article that just came out the other day in the Union Leader, which identified, I think it was 1,100 or over 1,100 students just in Manchester alone, students identified as homeless. That's an undercount. We're only counting, you know, students there who are enrolled in K through 5. The research shows that most kids who are homeless are under age 5. So when we're thinking about the total number of children who are homeless, then, you know, the number just gets really astounding.
And real quickly, Representative Long, she says you haven't addressed the issue of homeless veterans. And she's right. We haven't talked specifically about that. But I did come across an article that said that New Hampshire has made some progress in addressing at least that piece of the pie, homeless veterans.
Well, at the federal level, there's been a more of an initiative on addressing homelessness. Although with sequestration, it's been homelessness has been funding has been going down. With veteran homelessness, I don't know if it's been going up, but at least it's been kept steady. I know Harbor Homes in Nashua and recently built a place in Manchester with availability. So I think
specifically
veterans,
focused at veterans.
Correct. And I believe that veterans are, you know, veterans, there's more available help out there for veterans. They just need to get the right contact.
Let's take another call. This is Alex waiting in Rochester. Hi, Alex. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm listening with interest to this conversation because I myself have been homeless, although I haven't been homeless for quite a while. I currently have housing in Rochester, but I have a mental illness. I do get medical help for that, but I've been homeless both in Dover, New Hampshire, as well as in Portsmouth years ago, as well as other parts of the country. And here in Rochester, where I live, Rochester, New Hampshire, the city has been considering passing an ordinance to prevent what's called so-called aggressive panhandling. And I wrote a letter to the editor of the weekly paper here, the Rochester Times, about that issue, describing how, from my perspective, that might not be such a good idea because it might not only be unconstitutional, but it could also, you know, freedom of speech issues, but it could also, you know, further stigmatize and criminalize people who are down and out. And also, I came across, and you were also talking about homeless veterans, there's an article in the March 2012 magazine, the American Legion magazine, which is published by the American Legion. It talks about how recent studies from the VA and the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, estimate that about 67,000 veterans are homeless on any given night in the U.S.
Wow, it's a lot, huh?
And Alex,
if I could ask you a quick question, because we're coming close to the end of the program. I'm glad you called, and I'm glad you highlight that, you know, homelessness is taking place in these other cities, too. What led you to this situation? Was it your mental illness, or was it something else?
It was my mental illness. I was completely sober, but I was struggling with mental illness and wasn't getting successful treatment. It wasn't my fault. You know, I was doing the best that I could. I grew up in Nashua in a nice middle-class family. I actually went to UNH. I have a college degree, and I actually had a college degree at the time that I was homeless. and mentally ill. And so, you know, when you have a mental illness, you can pass all kinds of laws, but if you, it's still very easy to fall through the cracks. You know, and so I've had difficult landlords, I've had difficult situations, and I'm not just painting myself as a victim, but it's not easy to get by when you have a mental illness, even if you have a college degree.
Okay. Alex, thank you very much for calling in. I really appreciate it, and good luck.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And Kathy, the studies that I've looked at show mental illness is a big, big part of this population.
Yes, it is. The percentage of people with mental illness is much higher in the homeless population than it is in the general population.
Yeah. As we look at this problem broadly, and boy, we've only scratched the surface, but Tana Sisko, I was interested in what Representative Long said earlier. You know, it's a big puzzle. If we could just take off one piece of that puzzle, what would it be to at least make a dent in this? Would it be, you know, mental illness? Would it be substance abuse? Would it be joblessness? What would it be?
Affordable housing.
Really?
Yes. That has been the trend since the 1980s. Rents have increased and increased and increased. And thus, individuals who are employed or underemployed are not able to afford affordable housing.
All right. Well, a lot more to talk about in the future. I want to thank all of you very much for coming in. Representative Long, thank you for your time. Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It. That's Representative Pat Long, Alderman of Ward 3 and a Democratic state representative from Manchester. Tana Sisko, nice to meet you. Thank you
nice
for being
you well.
Here. Tana Sisko, political sociologist at St. Anselm College. Her forthcoming book is The Gendered Face of Homelessness. And Kathy Kuhn, thank you also for your time.
Thank you so much.
Kathy Kuhn, director of the New Hampshire Coalition to End Homelessness and director of research and training at Families in Transition, a homeless service provider. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our interns are Faith Meixel and Tim Camerato. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.